The patrolmen of the city are entirely too reckless with their revolvers and clubs, and it is about time a stop was put to their shooting and brutality. They defy the law and act on their own responsibility, but their superiors would seem to wink at their crime since it is useless to make complaint. They always manage to go scot-free, unless the victim or his friends go over on the north side for justice. This sounds a lot like the sort of thing we're reading in the papers this week in Chicago after the video of an officer shooting a kid 16 times was released. There are protesters in the streets, and for a fairly obvious reason. So in this case, it's pretty obvious the officer lied about what happened and the force tried to cover it up. Now, I confess that I don't really see how blocking people from going shopping is going to win them over to your side, but obviously something's got to give. Besides this, we've been getting all these reports that sound like something out of a wild conspiracy theory, stuff about secret facilities in Holman Square where suspects are being held and interrogated. Really, since when has Chicago had that much trust in our public officials? Most of my dealings with the cops in the city have been very professional, good people doing good work, though I can also throw out some anecdotes that show another side. Now, an article I dug up online recently had a quote from the 1920s saying the Chicago Police Department was rotten to the core. And really, accusations like that from high place sources go back way further than that. And I'm not here to talk about today's police department, obviously. This is a history podcast, after all. It's not a polemic, or I'm not aiming to be controversial here. The quote I just read came from a Chicago Tribune article. The quote about the police are entirely too reckless with their revolvers, that was from a Tribune article from 1879. It happened that year there was an officer named Officer William Croak. I swear I'm not making up that name. Charles Dickens couldn't have given the guy a better name. An officer named William Croak saw this young black man walking across Wabash Street looking like he had something under his coat. He tried to arrest him, a struggle ensued, and when the guy ran, the cop shot him twice while his partner beat him with a club. This was pretty much par for the course in those days. When somebody ran, it was just a given that the cops could shoot, even though it was not entirely constitutional, I don't think. In 1858, like, they saw a group of grave robbers hauling a body from a cemetery to a school, and when they tried to flee, the cops just opened fire. Now, these were grave robbers. They were like violent criminals that had to be stopped or anything. It's hard to justify actually shooting them just because they were running away in that case. What's interesting about the 1879 case is that witness after witness came forward to condemn the cops. Like, the reporter tracked down a guy named Colonel Van Arman, who said that no law authorized the cops to shoot a man for running. It was unconstitutional. It wasn't illegal to have something under your coat after a while. He said, quote, "The shooting of that Negro the other day was the greatest outrage I ever heard of. Our policemen have gotten into the habit of chasing people and shooting at them. That officer had no right even to arrest him." Now, even the mayor had some wisecracks to make, and at the inquest, witness after witness came forth and said the shooting was totally unjustified. Now, this isn't to say that everyone thought that. A rival paper, The Inner Ocean, thought it was just despicable that anyone would criticize the police or defend a guy who might have been stealing a set of silverware like this, especially after it came out that the suspect lived in a house of ill fame with a prostitute named Lizzie Moore. The Tribune said of it, what they said was, quote, "Considering that this colored individual is commonly regarded as the lover of this degraded woman, it is reasonable to suppose that such testimony did not lend any exaltation to the man's character. But, at the same time, it is hard to see how his general worthlessness justified the officers in attempting to kill him." Now, still in the end, the officers were acquitted and put back on duty. The guy tried to sue them for $20,000 a couple of months later, but I don't think it went anywhere, which is generally how these things happened, both then and now. And the case I really want to look at here, it's kind of like we can look at all of the testimony and put together and try to form our own opinions as to what happened, because there are so many testimonies. This case from even earlier than that, where we've got so many verbatim testimonies that it turns into like a regular legal thriller. So we're going to take you back now to the 4th of July, 1872. The city is still recovering from a fire 9 months earlier that wrecked the whole city. Over in Green's Garden at Madison and Elizabeth, a guy is giving trapeze demonstrations while hanging from a hot air balloon, which is a subject for a whole other post later on. And down at Market in Illinois, which would be Illinois and Orleans today, two men, John McNamara and Dennis Kelly, are shot by Officer Dan Cronin after McNamara is caught throwing rocks at his windows. The Officer Dan Cronin is just about lynched by an angry mob. We're going to start here with Officer Cronin's testimony as printed in the July 5th, 1872, Inter Ocean. Now, keeping in mind, this is 1872. There are relief shacks and temporary housing everywhere. We're still recovering from the fire. This would be right about where the Ace Hardware is now, up in River North near the back of the Merchandise Mart. Officer Cronin says, About 3 o'clock this afternoon, as another officer and myself were coming past a relief shanty on Market Street, one door south of Illinois, we saw a big crowd gathered around. The glass was broken out of the windows and a woman was screaming in the house. We went to a man standing outside the house and asked him who did that. He said he did. We asked him what he did it for, and he said, for fun, that the house was his own, and if he did break the windows, it was nobody's business. We told him to go in the house and keep quiet and to quit beating his wife. We then told the crowd to disperse and went away. About 15 minutes afterward, I came back alone, and there was still disturbance there. I went down, and after some words, I attempted to arrest the man, whose name was McNamara. He ran into the house, and I followed him and clinched with him. He resisted, and we had it back and forth, back and forward. Sometimes he was on top, and sometimes I was. I soon saw he was too much for me, and I got away from him and pulled out my club. He clinched me again, and took my club away from me and struck me 2 or 3 times with it across the shoulders. A man then pushed the door open behind me and came up toward me with a brick in his hand. He said, "Damn you, you can't take nobody away from here," and when he was about 4 or 5 feet from me, he threw the brick at me but missed me. They both then closed with me, and after it, I broke away from them, and when they came at me again, I pulled my revolver and shot. I got out of the house then and went after an express wagon to take the wounded men away. I did not know then of their being too hurt. When I got back with the wagon, I learned that the man was killed. There was a big mob around the house, and several people threatened to kill me. Another officer came along and told me I had best go away. They all made a rush for me, and I got in the express wagon and came away. So that testimony sounds kind of like an open and shut case. It sounds like no one's going to defend a drunken wife beater. But the mob clearly did want to defend both of these guys. And here's what Mrs. McNamara immediately told reporters: that John never beat her. He might have been drinking, but, you know, she said so did everybody else. It was the 4th of July. She didn't see the whole fight. She just saw John being chased into the house and beaten and then shot. At the same time, a young Irish boy named Lewis Harney gave the following statement. The officer said to Johnny to come go along with him. Johnny said no man could take him out of his own house. The officer and Johnny tussled in the room there, and the officer pulled him to the door. Mrs. McNamara shut the door. Johnny told her to keep the door shut so that the policeman could not get him out. The policeman said that if she did not open the door, he would arrest her too. Johnny pulled the policeman back into the room, and the policeman began beating him with his club. Johnny hallooed for the policeman to stop beating him. Kelly then pushed the door open and went in with a brick in his hand to help McNamara. The policeman and Kelly and McNamara then fought with each other, and the policeman pulled out his pistol and shot Kelly first through the head and then shot McNamara. So those are the first couple of accounts of what happened. The next day, they had an inquest over the body right there at McNamara's house. I guess they must have kept him in there overnight. One witness was Mrs. Mary Riley, who resided at 55 and a half North Market Street, just opposite the house. While walking in front of her own house, she heard a noise in the direction of the house of the deceased in the rear of number 58 Market Street. Saw Mr. Kelly run up the front steps of the house of the deceased, accompanied by a boy. The police officer struck at Kelly, who raised his arm to ward off the blow, and... it's a little hard to read here, but struck at the officer. The officer at the moment was dragging the body of the deceased through the doorway. Saw the officer draw a revolver in his right hand, remove the cover with his left hand, and immediately fire. Did not notice whether Mr. Kelly had anything in his hand. Have seen deceased slightly intoxicated, but do not know that he was quarrelsome. He had a good reputation in the immediate neighborhood. Next up is the testimony of one Thomas Howie, who resides at number 62 Market Street. On the afternoon of the 4th of July, he saw John McNamara, the deceased, throwing stones through the windows of his own house. Police officers came up and asked deceased who had broken the windows. Deceased answered that he had, and they were his own windows, and that he should do as he pleased with his own property. The officers then asked the wife of the deceased if anything was wrong, and she said no. One of the officers then said, "Let them kill each other if they wish to," and both walked away. The deceased again resumed his destructive proceedings, but one of the officers, witness here identified Officer Cronin, came back, walked into the house, took deceased by the collar, and said he should arrest him. Deceased said he would not go with him. The officers then struck him with the side of a policeman's club and said that if anyone closed the door, he would arrest him when he came back. Kelly then came to the door and pushed it open and endeavored to get between the officer and the deceased. The officers twice struck Kelly on the head with his club. Kelly had a brick in his hand, which he threw it toward the officer. Both Kelly and the deceased then entered the house and closed the door. The officer then put his hand into his pistol pocket and drew a revolver. He pushed open the door and fired into the house. Deceased then came out of the house, and the officer shot again, and the deceased fell. When the officer went toward the deceased and tried to lift him up, the officer explained, "I will stand for this." Both Kelly and deceased were intoxicated, but the latter was more under the influence of liquor than the former. Deceased had a quarrel with a woman named McGuire in the morning. Deceased took hold of the club while the officers were striking him, but the officer wrested it from him again. Next up, John Harding, who resided at 57 Illinois Street. On the 4th of July in the afternoon, witness said he was going north on Market Street from Kinsey, heard some crashing noises as if breaking windows, and thought it was done by children as there were some playing near the house, number 58 Market Street. An officer was seen to enter the house and the witness then heard several strokes as if made by a club and heard a woman cry out not to kill her husband. Witness then saw the officer coming out of the door, and it seemed as if he had the come along on a man. He got him partly out of the door when another man stepped up and threw a brick at the officer. The officer then let go of the prisoners, and both the men stepped into the house. The officer drew a revolver, stepped further away from the doorway, and fired into the room. A man staggered out and fell on his face in the yard. Witness heard two shot fired, did not think the brick struck the officer. Now, based on these few fairly similar pieces of testimony, the jury couldn't reach a decision. The first jury was discharged. Another jury was brought in. They eventually voted to acquit, so Officer Cronin was back on the streets. Now, personally, I'm not sure how I would have voted. My first thing is I'm not really sure that you had any grounds to go in and or try to arrest McNamara in the first place. It is probably illegal to throw bricks at your own windows. If the wife had been saying that, you know, you need to come and get my husband, he's beating me, he's damaging our property, that would have been one thing. But by all accounts, other than the officers alone, she didn't. By her own account, she was in no danger. By the other neighbor's account, she was yelling for the cop to stop. Personally, though, I think once the guy got a brick thrown at him, by the standards of the day, maybe it wasn't good police work, but it was probably legal. And what we start seeing later in the archives is more and more cases where it's not quite so much that the police were overzealous in shooting. In the late 19th and early 20th century, there start to be a lot more cases where it seems like they're basically using torture to get confessions. And in those days, no matter how scant the evidence was or how many reputable allies you had, if you made a confession, that was it. One case that we wrote about on the blog last week was Buff Higgins, who was in prison at the same time as Patrick Prendergast, who had assassinated Mayor Harrison in 1893. Now, there have been several people saying, both at the time and now, that Prendergast never should have been hanged. Lots of people tried to plea insanity in those days. In Prendergast's case, the man was pretty clearly schizophrenic, and if he'd killed anyone else, he would have been treated as insane in court. But because he had killed the mayor, he was hanged. Not a lot of attention was ever really paid to Buff Higgins, a small-time crook who was in jail with him, awaiting hanging for murder. The guy had been arrested many times, mostly just for, like, petty stuff over the time. It was actually a judge who brought this one up. A guy named Judge Goggin in the late 1890s said that he was writing a book that was going to be all about the questionable methods that the police in Chicago were using. The book was never actually published, but there was a large excerpt of it that was published in the Chicago Tribune. Here's his thing about Buff Higgins. Buff Higgins was arrested on the charge of murder and taken to the Maxwell Street station. There, he was stripped naked and thrown into a cell where he was left for 4 days without food. During this time, attorney A.J. Hanion called to see Higgins and was refused admission. The fourth day of his confinement, the captain in charge of the station went down to Higgins' cell to see him and said, "Buff, it is an outrage for you to be treated like this. You must be feeling pretty slim. Don't you want a bottle of whiskey?" Higgins replied that he would like to have something to drink and said that if the captain would look in his pockets of his clothes that had been taken from him, he would find some money with which to buy liquor. 50 cents of Higgins' confiscated coin was spent in this way, and he was given a good-sized flask of grog. Having had nothing to eat and weakened by his fast, he drank the pint of whiskey in a few hours and became hopelessly drunk. While in this condition, he was again called upon by the captain, who repeated the statement that Higgins was being treated outrageously and told the latter that he was not guilty and ought not to be in jail at all. With that, the police captain told his charge that he would send down the clothing that had been taken from him when he was arrested and wanted him to come up to his office. Higgins complied, and in the captain's office was shown a paper which, he was informed, was a written statement setting forth the claims of innocence Higgins had made when he was arrested and giving an account of the prisoner's whereabouts at the time of the commission of the murder. He was asked to sign this paper, and under the supposition that it was a statement of innocence and a claim of an alibi for himself, he signed it. The paper contained a complete confession of the crime, including particulars as to the manner of its commission, and upon the strength of that statement, Higgins was hanged for a crime of which the police knew him to be innocent. It was not Higgins' first experience with the police, though his last. He had been arrested over 200 times, the first time on a charge of stealing a bunch of grapes, and though the police had never secured his conviction on any charge of larceny or burglary or any similar offense, he had been sent to the Bridewell over 100 times on charges of disorderly conduct, vagrancy, and the like. Now, it should be noted, Goggin didn't say where he got all his information on what was done with Higgins. It doesn't totally line up with the stories that went around at the time, but these kind of stories went around all the time in those days, and it wasn't until much later that people became open to the idea that a confession wasn't necessarily solid gold evidence. We now know that false confessions really aren't all that unusual. When I look at cases that led to hangings in those days, there's just case after case where the evidence probably wouldn't be allowed in court today for one reason or another. So I'm not saying this to take a stand on the events of the day, just to point out that these events and controversy are nothing new. We do have to ask who's watching the Watchers sometimes. It does no favor to the good cops to ignore the bad ones. So, I know, there's not a whole lot of mysteries here. We don't really know if Buff Higgins wasn't the killer in that case, who was? Would you have voted to convict Officer Cronin? Would you have voted to convict Officer Croak? Little mysteries in every little case here. Quick plug, we've got the Unsolved Mystery Tour is still on sale coming up December 12th. Also, the Devil in the White City Tour, the H.H. Holmes Myth and Mystery. There's still a few tickets left for that. Also, our big Drink Like the Dickens event is on sale now. If all this talk about the 19th century has gotten you thirsty for Port Negus or Rocky Mountain sneezers, come over to MysteriousChicago.com. Look up all the information right there. We'll be back with more stuff about H.H. Holmes, antique serial killers, and mysterious inventors in the next coming weeks. This is Adam, MysteriousChicago.com.